It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. In the midst of final exams, it turns out that the mumps is hitting college communities across Wisconsin.
Four new cases have been reported in Milwaukee, two of them on the UW-Milwaukee campus, along with several new cases at the UW-Madison, bringing the total count to 27 statewide so far this spring.
University Health Services epidemiologist Craig Roberts joins us now for an update on the mumps outbreak and how to avoid it. Craig is also a clinical assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Welcome to Central Time, Craig.
Thanks, Gene.
I want a little bit of a history lesson here, because when I was a kid back in the 60s, all of my classmates got the mumps, and then they kind of went away for a while, and now they're popping back up in college kids. What's going on?
All right. That was my experience, too, since we're almost the same age.
Mm-hmm.
The mumps vaccine came on the market in the late 60s and probably wasn't in universal use until well into the 80s before it became sort of every kid was getting that vaccine and had really good coverage. And now we see college students who've all, for the most part, had the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Unfortunately, the mumps component of the vaccine is not always 100% efficacious. And so what happens 20 years later is some of those students and other young adults develop waning immunity. So they basically are no longer protected. And given an exposure, they can become infected and develop disease.
Is there a way that as you look at the course of this that you can sort of predict what's going to happen, or do these upticks kind of come out of nowhere?
Well, mumps is a pretty uncommon disease these days,
but
we do tend to see large outbreaks happening. In 2006, there was a very large outbreak in the Midwest that started in Iowa and included cases in Minnesota and Wisconsin as well. And then this year, we've seen cases at Ohio State, at Fordham University in New York, as well as other schools around Wisconsin. So at UW-Madison, we actually went several years without seeing a single case until this spring.
And so 27 cases is the number I heard for statewide right now. Is that a number that we should be concerned about, or is this just sort of an interesting story?
That's an interesting question, because how many is too many is sort of where we are. Mumps is not a pleasant disease to have for most people, and so it has the potential for some uncomfortable complications. In most adults, it's going to be a self-limiting illness, but we'd rather see that number be zero. And the most recent update, it looks like there are actually now 30 cases statewide as of this afternoon. There will be an update coming from the Division of Public Health later today, I believe.
So let's talk a little bit about how it spreads. Based on my experience in second grade back in the day, it spreads pretty easily, as I recall.
It's a relatively infectious, contagious disease. So it's sort of similar to something like the flu or other respiratory illnesses, spread by coughing, sneezing, exposure to saliva, respiratory droplets, that sort of thing.
Almost like just being in the room with somebody can be enough sometimes.
Well, probably more than just being in the same room, but being in close physical contact with that person. Typically, we think about a 3-foot kind of range with these kind of illnesses, respiratory viruses.
And so given all of that, what could a typical young person do if they are in a college situation? There's a lot of classroom, there's a lot of hallways, there's a lot of after-hours activities. How do you take care of yourself?
There's two things that are very important, particularly for mumps. One is the general advice we give to trying to prevent all sort of respiratory illness and influenza and colds and cough and all those other sort of thing, which is pay careful attention to careful hand washing. After you use the bathroom, after coughing or sneezing, cough into your elbow rather than your hand. Avoid people who are coughing in your face, that sort of thing. We call good respiratory hygiene. And then the second thing is to make sure that your immunizations are current. For this particular disease in particular, every person who's in college these days and all adolescents, everyone who's in kindergarten through high school needs to have 2 doses of the MMR vaccine. And that also applies to anyone who's working in a healthcare setting.
So is it a good idea to get revaccinated?
Not at this time. There's no recommendation for a third dose, and that's actually kind of important to know because there's no evidence that really does anything. We can't really predict who is at risk of developing mumps once they've been immunized with the 2 doses. It's sort of a random shot in terms of who might be out there that's now susceptible.
So, yeah, you talked about sort of the waning influence of some of these vaccines. So people should just assume that it could be happening to them and take the appropriate precautions?
Well, we know even in this population, probably 85 to 90% of those students are protected and covered if they had their two doses in childhood. So the vast majority of people who had two doses are fine, and they don't have to worry about anything. And again, the other 10 to 15% are people we simply aren't going to know about. And there are still some people out there in this age group, in this population, who have only had one dose for whatever reason. And so those are the people that we're trying to get in touch with. We sent out a mass email to all of our students. I believe Milwaukee has done the same thing, really trying to make people to check their records, find out if they're behind in their immunizations, and to catch up.
And we've been focusing a lot on college campuses here because that's sort of where you've been seeing the upticks, as I understand it. What about other young people who may be somewhere else, not necessarily on a college campus? I'm guessing that they should be aware of this too.
Right. This is not a unique problem with college students. We've seen cases in Wisconsin now. We've seen other cases in other young adults. The median age of our cases in Wisconsin right now is of the first 27 cases is 22 years of age. So it is this outbreak appears to very much be a young adult phenomena.
So remind me what the symptoms of the mumps are and what they'll feel like to somebody who might be getting them and what they ought to do if they think that they may have been exposed, that they may be getting them.
Sure. The classic finding with mumps that everybody thinks about is sort of the chipmunk appearance. And that's caused by the swelling or inflammation of one of the salivary glands, the parotid gland that's typically it's located in front of the ear and above the last molar. So the classic mumps, that gland swells up, is painful and sore. That's usually preceded by several days of general viral kind of illness with sore throat, headache, fatigue, fever. Those are very common symptoms as well. And then sometimes some neck pain, lymph node swelling would be the other typical things that people get. With this outbreak, I should note that a lot of people don't get those classic large swollen cheeks. And there seems to be a milder illness in many of our students that have been confirmed to have a mumps viral illness. And we think that's because of their prior immunization that they may have just some, they're not as well covered as they could be, so their illness is a little milder.
So do you go to the doctor? Do you just suffer at home?
Sure. So if you think you might be coming down with mumps, particularly if you have swelling of your salivary glands and pain or tenderness in your jaw, that's an important time to go see your provider. And you can actually get tested for this. There's a specific swab we take from the cheek that will tell us if it's a mumps virus. And it's important for healthcare providers to know, and our health departments have been working to get the word out about that, that that is the best test to use for diagnosing people with a possible mumps illness. So the blood test, there is a blood test that is not actually very reliable anymore for diagnosing mumps in people who have been previously immunized.
So we don't know exactly how this year is going to turn out, but as you look down the road a year or two or three, were there changes in vaccines or anything like that, or do we expect this to pop up again in future years in people at about the same age?
I think we'll continue to see outbreaks showing up occasionally, probably every few years in people of this age, even in a well-immunized population. That's sort of different than measles, which most of the measles cases that are occurring in the world and in the United States right now are in people who have not had that vaccine. But mumps, even in a well-immunized population, we probably will continue to see outbreaks and cases, probably going more in waves. That is, we may go a couple years without any and then have outbreaks like we're seeing this year.
And finally, the last question, what about kids who may not have gotten the mumps back in the 60s and are now adults in their 50s or 60s, do they need to be concerned about this?
Well, they could be. Mumps disease was an almost universal phenomena in kids back in the 60s and even into the 70s. But there probably are a proportion of people who may not have been immunized and may have escaped natural infection if they were born in the late 60s or 70s. As the population, more and more kids were getting immunized and the incidence of the disease was decreasing during that time frame. So some of those people may be susceptible also. So there is a guideline that all adults should have at least one dose. The two-dose recommendation, again, is in place for people who are in school, K through 12, or college students and healthcare workers.
All right, great. Well, Craig, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking with Craig Roberts, an epidemiologist with University Health Services and a clinical assistant professor in the School of Medicine and Public Health, both at the UW-Madison. He specializes in infectious disease epidemiology, and he also serves as the chair of the Emerging Public Health Threats and Emergency Response Coalition of the American College Health Association.
Our next guest is a maker who spent years combing through DIY books looking for fun and tech-savvy projects he could share with his two daughters, projects that weren't dumbed down and didn't require a splash of pink paint.
Well, in a new book, he details 22 of his favorite father-daughter projects, ones that encourage both father and daughters to geek out and get creative, and to help girls cultivate an early affinity for science, math, technology, and engineering, the STEM fields.
Joining us now is Mark Frauenfelder. He's editor-in-chief of Make Magazine and the founder of the hit website Boing Boing. His new book is called Maker Dad, Lunchbox Guitars, Anti-Gravity Jars, and 22 Other Incredibly Cool Father-Daughter DIY Projects. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot.
So you're a father of two daughters, as we said. Why was it important to you to find projects that you could do with your daughters?
Well, because I like to spend time with my kids, and I also like to have fun when I'm spending time with my kids. I've found that if the kid's having fun doing something and the parent's not, the kid will sense that. And so what I wanted to do was come up with projects that we actually both really enjoy doing together. And so, you know, my daughters helped me do that. We just kind of went around the world, our neighborhood and town, and if we saw something that intrigued us, we would try to do our own version. I remember a couple of years ago, we were in a little boutique in Venice, California, and we saw these little soap shapes that had been cast from baby doll arms. So it was soap in the shape of like a little baby's fist, and my daughters thought that they were really cute. And I said, you know, I bet we could make something like that at home, and we could cast different plastic objects. And so we found out about silicone rubber molding compound and glycerin soap that you could heat up in a microwave and different kinds of coloring agents and different fragrances. And we ended up making our own soap shapes. And that was one of the projects we put in the book.
And you're also emphasizing here the daughter aspect of it. You're reaching out to girls. How come?
Well, because I took a look at some of the books that were geared towards parents and children-based crafts, and there are a lot of great books out there, but most of them are for boys. And I got some of the books, and they just really did not appeal that much to my daughters. A lot of them were about cars, vehicles, and although I know a lot of girls like that kind of stuff, my girls happen not to be that interested in those kinds of things. And so it ended up that, you know, the projects, every project in here is something that my two daughters really liked. And so I thought this should be a book for parents and daughters.
And yet these aren't, you know, girly projects. It's not as though, you know, as we said, everything involves pink paint and glitter or anything like that. These are things that they're just cool projects for kids.
Yeah, definitely. I you know, my daughters like doing things on the computer. And they like video games, so one of the things is programming your own video game using a really cool programming language that was developed at MIT for kids called Scratch, where you kind of drag and drop your commands into a window, and you kind of snap them together like Lego pieces almost, and you can write programs that way. And my 11-year-old daughter loves playing with Scratch and comes up with all sorts of interactive programs using it. So they definitely, I mean, really the book could be for any adult and child to do together, but it definitely works as a dad and daughter combination.
Something like coding a video game, that sounds kind of intimidating too. I bet a lot of grown-ups, but you did it with your kids. How daunting are these projects, including that one?
Well, you know, it's not that hard. I mean, really, what I wanted to make sure that there were no barriers to entry in any of the projects so that you could start one out with zero experience or knowledge and have the steps really clearly outlined. So with with the retro arcade video game program, if you just follow along the instructions, you will end up with a video game at the end, along with suggestions on how to tweak and modify it. Some of the projects are a little more challenging. I think the most challenging one probably is using the Arduino, which is an electronics prototyping platform. It's a really cool device that costs about $25, and it lets you emulate electronic circuits. It was designed for artists and designers to put interactivity into their projects. And you can make all sorts of really cool things with it, but it's kind of an intimidating-looking thing. It's a printed circuit board with all sorts of components and pins and little LEDs on it and things. But if you follow the instructions in the book, you will be able to do all sorts of things like generate tones. You can control a servo motor with a potentiometer. You can adjust the frequency coming out of a buzzer by shining a light on the Arduino. And, you know, it sounds like it might be complicated, but it really isn't that tough to do. I've taught an Arduino workshops to kids who are as young as 9 or 10, and they get it. So that was one of the things that I really wanted to make sure was that the projects were sophisticated and satisfying and somewhat challenging, but also not so difficult that they would discourage anyone.
Yeah, and I bet if you do make it through that and you master the Arduino or whatever it's called, that you do have a sense of the horizons that you can go to and feeling of accomplishment, and that maybe you can do the next step up, too, if you're a girl.
That's definitely what I wanted to do. And there has been research showing that when you accomplish a task and it was a challenge at the right level where it just pushed you a little bit, you gain this sense of self-efficacy where you are then able to kind of raise your own bar and make, you know, challenge yourself a little bit, take on a more challenging task. And you just can continue to do that and get better and better and develop skills and experience. And as you do that, the whole world becomes a hackable platform where you become like a participant in the designed world around you rather than just the consumer. And it's a really cool experience to have, and it's really fun to see it happen with your kids.
Yeah, sounds really empowering. So let's talk about some of these projects that you've got in your book. One that just sounds super cool, the anti-gravity jar. What is that?
Oh, yeah. It's basically a magic trick. There are a couple of magic tricks in here. And this one it's one of the simplest tricks in the book, but the effect is pretty incredible. It is a paper clip inside of a glass jar that's like floating, kind of like a helium balloon attached to a string. It's a paper clip attached to a little thread, and it's just floating inside the jar. And the idea is that it's filled with an anti-gravity fluid that's keeping it floating. But the secret is, of course, at the top of the lid is a magnet. You can't see it, but it's a really powerful magnet, and it's pulling the paper clip up. But the effect is cool because the paperclip's kind of wobbling a little bit. So you have this feeling that there's some kind of energy inside there.
Ah, so that's cool. So that's one of those amaze your friends and family with the anti-gravity jar.
Exactly.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun one for, especially maybe a younger girl who wants to get into magic. One that I really loved was the Friendstrument. Which was little intimidating to me, even as a grown-up. But explain the Friendstrument to us.
Yeah. That was an interesting one because I started out trying to make a lie detector bracelet for one of my daughters, and it just was like too bulky and weird, but I loved the sound, that weird like beeping, warbling electronic sound that it made. So what we ended up doing was having a little box with some electronic circuitry inside, and there's two pennies on the box. It looks kind of mysterious, like what are these two pennies? And one kid touches a penny, and then the other kid touches the other penny, and then when the kids touch each other, you complete the circuit, and you can make sound. So if you hold the other person's hand and squeeze, it will actually change the tone of the speaker. Hmm. So you can basically play music by touching your friend, pinching their ear or touching their nose. it's really a lot of fun, and kids always laugh when they play with it.
That one sounds fantastic. I think I may actually try to do that one. Well, we're talking right now with Mark Frauenfelder, author of Maker Dad, about some great father-daughter DIY projects. And we'd like to hear from you, too. If you're a Maker Dad and you've engineered some cool projects for your kids or your son or daughter, for that matter, we want to hear about it. Call us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Mark Frauenfelder from Make Magazine about fun and tech-savvy DIY projects for dads and daughters. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What kinds of cool, geeky projects have you done with your kids, boys or girls? And what did they take away from the experience? Did you see them growing as they learned to make stuff and had a fun experiences doing it? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Mark, I'm going to go to the calls right now and take our first caller, Jennifer in Milwaukee. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I was thinking that this book sounds like something that would be great for my daughter to buy for her father for Father's Day. But I was wanting to know what she was thinking the age range of these projects would be. I understand that some of them are on complex side, but I'm assuming some of them got to be a little easier and maybe might be more appropriate for younger girls.
Okay, good question, Jennifer. Mark, what is the age range on this?
Yeah, I think that a good number of the projects could probably be done with 8-year-old girls, and then some of the more difficult ones probably, I think that 10 or 11 is probably the youngest. My 10-year-old daughter was able to do everything in the book. We did the projects together, and it is supposed to be one that's, you know, for dads and daughters or mothers and kids to do together. At the beginning of the book, I have a little code that describes each project as either being easy and quick, moderately challenging, or challenging. And I think it's probably a third of each are, you know, a third are easy, a third are medium, and a third are challenging.
Okay, so a bit of a range there, so
yeah.
Between 8 and 11. Perfect. Well, good luck to you, Jennifer. Appreciate that question. And Mark, let's talk about another one of your projects. And some of them, we've talked about some of the more difficult ones. Let's talk about some of the easier ones now. A bubble wand, a giant bubble wand, which I have to say looked pretty darn impressive. How do you do that?
You can make some really cool, gigantic bubbles with these things. And so it's not like a typical bubble wand. What you use is a couple of sticks, like dowels, and then you have a big loop of T-shirt material. And you cut the T-shirt, so you cut the material so it's in the shape of a ring. You know what I mean? Like you would cut like the bottom, a circle all the way around the bottom of a T-shirt. And that material, that cotton material, is really good at soaking up bubble solution, and then you attach that loop of cloth to two sticks. There's a little bit more involved to it than that, but that's basically the shape of it, and then you dip it into a bucket of soap solution, and if it's a slightly breezy day, you let the wind do work for you, and if it's not breezy, you just kind of walk, not very quickly, you know, kind of just walk backwards slowly, and you can make this giant, really long bubble, and it's really fun to photograph because you can see all the different colors coming off of the bubble. It's pretty remarkable.
And also there's just nothing cooler than a really giant bubble.
Yeah.
I think kids universally agree on that.
Yeah, totally. And it's so much, I mean, everybody has phones with videos on them now, so they make great videos. And if you have slow-mo on your camera, you can do some really fun videos with it.
Okay, so moving from that one, which is, you know, kind of simple and fun, we've got another one which is a little more complicated, could be ongoing, could lead to, you know, fame and fortune, and that is a podcast, creating a podcast.
Oh, yeah, that was a really fun one. Jane, my 11-year-old, and I, we do a podcast called Apps for Kids, where we talk about fun smartphone apps for kids and parents. And so why not... I would love to have more parents and kids do podcasts together. So we talk about the microphone setup that you need, how to record it, how to edit it, how to upload it to a computer, finding a service that will host your files, how to get it onto iTunes, all that kind of stuff, step by step. It's not hard to do, and it's how fun is that? You know, making your own show and having it available for the world to listen to.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, this is one that's pretty techie. This has got a lot of computer stuff going on in it, and given what we know about needing more women and girls to get interested in science, tech, engineering, math, that kind of thing, do you see sort of that at the end of the tunnel when you're thinking about a project like a podcast?
Oh, yeah, I definitely do. I mean, you're learning about a lot of different technical things, and you're becoming comfortable with different kinds of computer applications. You're learning about acoustics. That kind of hands-on physical experience with technology so that you become familiarized with it is really important. I think it's even more important than kind of an intellectual grasp of technology, to actually, like, to try things out and say, oh, you know, that the way that when I put the microphone in a room without any carpeting, you know, it's I get this weird echo sound. And so, I mean, just learning about that stuff intuitively is such a huge help for math and science related fields later on, if you want to be an engineer or a scientist.
Now, you are obviously sort of an expert, not even sort of. You're an expert when it comes to making things. You're the founder of Make Magazine. But for parents who might not be anywhere near that that savvy, working with their hands or working with rudimentary technology, they're a little green. What advice can you give?
The same advice that other people gave me when I was starting out making it and kind of fearful of doing it, and that is to get over the idea that mistakes are a bad thing. So many people are really discouraged because they're afraid that they're going to make a mistake, and I think that that's not their fault. When we go to school, we learn that mistakes equal bad grades, and so we're like trained, we're hardwired now to think that the best thing to do in life is to avoid making mistakes. But really, to be a maker, you have to really embrace the idea that mistakes are inevitable. And that's not to say that you should intentionally try to make mistakes. You should try not to make mistakes. But you have to also realize that mistakes are going to happen and that you should look at them as ways to learn and opportunities to discover things that you didn't know before, and also to, like, sometimes I'll make a mistake on something, kind of like the Friendstrument. When I tried to make the lie detector out of a bracelet, and I just couldn't get it. And instead of saying, well, that was a failure, I took that mistake and turned it into something that was probably even more fun and original than a lie detector.
And for a parent who is a little green, and so they've gotten this pep talk from you about not worrying so much about mistakes, what is a great first project from your book?
Oh, let's see. I think that probably the polymer clay project is so much fun. That's something actually I learned from my daughters. Polymer clay, it looks like ordinary modeling clay, and you can mold it into any shape you want. It comes in a huge variety of colors, including metallic colors and stuff. But once you make something cool that you like, you can just pop it into the toaster oven for about 20 minutes, and it hardens into a permanent plastic object. And so it's something that's anyone can mold things with clay and have fun with that. So what we did was we made a necklace out of it looks like little Neapolitan chocolate ice cream sandwiches. And it looks like you could actually eat them. And that would be a great project for someone who has not made something before, to make a little polymer clay, animal or food item.
Oh, sounds like a lot of fun. Well, Mark, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me, Veronica.
We've been talking to Mark Frauenfelder, editor-in-chief of Make Magazine and the founder of the culture and technology website Boing Boing. His new book is called Maker Dad, and he joined us to share some cool dad and daughter DIY projects. Right now it's time for our weekly Wisconsin news update. This week, big news in the ongoing John Doe investigation and an update on the UW system reserves.
Noah Ovshinsky is back with us now in studio. Hey, Noah.
Good afternoon.
I want to start out with an observation about the John Doe rulings that came out this week. And the level of bafflement on my part is amazing, because I'm not sure which end is up right now.
Yeah, I sometimes joke, and frankly, it's only a half of a joke, that I wish I would have gone to law school before I got into journalism, because it would have made my job a lot easier.
Yeah, this is a tough one. A lot of twists and turns this week.
It is a complicated case. Really, the headline here, the big development, is this John Doe investigation that has been ongoing now for a few years. It's been looking at what prosecutors consider potentially to be illegal coordination between conservative groups and Governor Walker's campaign, as well as other campaigns during the recall elections of 2011 and 2012. And this has been an ongoing, an ongoing case. And the big development is it stopped.
Twice.
Yeah, it's been stopped twice, technically. It was stopped initially by Judge Rudolph Randa, and he issued an initial order earlier this week saying that the investigation essentially endangered the First Amendment rights of the groups that this investigation was targeting, these political groups. And he issued an order stopping the investigation, which is unusual, because no charges have been filed. You know, this is just an investigation being conducted by law enforcement. And now you mentioned he's stopped it twice, and it's true. He did stop it twice this week, because his first order was essentially squashed by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And the court essentially said that Judge Randa had not followed the right protocol when he made that order suspending the investigation. The appeals court said that Randa had to actually officially rule that this appeal that prosecutors were making to the appeals court was frivolous before he could actually stop it. Randa took that advice, more or less, and in the second ruling, a day or two later, said, in fact, that this appeal was frivolous. So now the investigation is once again suspended.
And so here we are, but that leaves us with some questions, doesn't it?
It does. You know, the question now will be, will prosecutors appeal this latest ruling? Chances are they will, but they haven't yet. And I guarantee you there are reporters around the state who are, watching the federal court records website like a hawk to see if the paperwork has been filed. But again, the prosecutors want this investigation into this, alleged coordination. They want the investigation to continue. And the only way that's going to happen is if the appeals court in Chicago intervenes and lets them continue that investigation.
So lots to think about. And as you say, a lot of people are going to be watching this very closely. And I have to say, it sort of feels like we're in uncharted waters. And I don't know that we are legally, but just the way it's happened in the last week, it's not like anything I've seen lately.
Yeah. The thing about this case is it deals with campaign finance law.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been so many changes in campaign finance law and rulings, significant rulings by the Supreme Court and U.S. Supreme Court and others. This is an investigation that is really at the heart of this. The question in this particular case is, how close are these groups to Governor Walker's campaign? And the answer to that question, according to campaign finance laws as they currently are written, determines, if they have to reveal their donors, if they have to abide by campaign finance limits, giving limits, So this question is to, how close they are to the Walker campaign or any other politician's campaign for that matter. That's that's under quite a bit of debate right now. How close is too close under the eyes of the law?
And all of this in the context of an election year that is just starting to heat up.
Exactly. I mean, we are the governor's campaign certainly has now picked up. And, you know, the chances are this is going to go through the appeal process. You know, the chances of this being wrapped up by November is slim. If anything, this ruling, as well as the likely appeals, will push this, you know, months and months and months and months down the road.
All right. Lots to watch there. Elsewhere this week, the legislature's Joint Committee on Finance met, and talking about university reserves, that was a big news story a year or so ago. And now they've come to, resolution, but there's some new rules.
Yeah. This is a new policy that was adopted by the Joint Finance Committee of the state legislature. And as you mentioned, they stem from the controversy that surrounded the surpluses that the system kept at a time when they were raising tuition and fees. And about a year ago, lawmakers felt at the time that they essentially had been duped, that they weren't told about these surpluses when they were, approving these tuition increases. The controversy led to, among other things, the tuition freeze that we've talked a lot about that was passed last year. And in fact, there are plans to pass yet another tuition freeze. So we'll have to wait to see what happens there. But all that being said, one of the things that came away from that controversy is how much is too much as far as reserves and the UW system. The system had suggested that the Board of Regents be notified if a fund balance gets above 15% of their expenditures. Now, the Joint Finance Committee, the lawmakers, agreed with the idea in principle of having sort of this ceiling, but lowered the threshold to 12%.
So they wanted to, the idea that there's this threshold that if it gets above that, they'd get some sort of notification. But it sounds like they want a little tighter rein on that.
Exactly. They want to be told, when they're just a little bit less. And there were other changes, too. The UW system also recommended that the regents be notified. Of course, we just talked about a ceiling. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the floor. And the UW system recommended that the regents be notified if fund balances dropped below 10%. So we talk about being notified above 15%, and now we're talking about they should be notified if fund balances drop below 10%.
But that was the university's recommendation. Right. The Joint Finance Committee took that a step further, too.
Quite a step further. The JFC liked the idea, again, of the floor, but they lowered that to zero. And they lowered it to zero because they were concerned that the system would use this new reporting requirement to boost their balances.
And so the vote came, and it was
passed unanimously.
So Republicans and Democrats on board for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. Thanks for that. And we've got news there from the Joint Finance Committee. Elsewhere, big, big story this week. Earlier in the week, we heard the news from the White House and a big presidential tour to follow. But the National Climate Assessment was released earlier this week. And what does it tell
us? Yes, the NCA. And it's being billed as the largest and most U.S.-centric report on climate change ever produced. And, of course, it looked across the country, but it also looked at the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin. The headline really is, that climate change, it's here. And it's already costing the country billions of dollars and causing a lot of problems for various regions around the country.
So it's already seeing some of the, you're saying climate change is here, but what does the report outline as some of the effects that we're already seeing?
Right. So according to the report, the Midwest will see, I'm going to quote directly from the report here. According to this report from the White House, the composition of the region's forests, so like northern Wisconsin, it's expected to change as rising temperatures drive habitats for many of these tree species northward. So we'll see the composition of forests change. Increased heat waves, in both intensity and the frequency of those heat waves. Increased humidity, degraded air quality, reduced water quality, which present a challenge to human health.
And so elsewhere, they also don't just stop at Wisconsin. They're talking about some of the the bigger bodies of like specifically water around here, and mm-hmm. the Great Lakes are in play in all of this as well.
Right. So according to this report, the climate change will have a huge effect on the Great Lakes. It will affect, according to this report, the range and distribution of certain fish species, increased invasive species in the Great Lakes, and harmful blooms of algae and declining beach health. So really, climate change is having and will have an increasingly worse effect on the Great Lakes.
And one of the things that some people think that they are already seeing are some of the weather events that are going to be increasing. They're talking about things like rain and flooding and so on.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have potentially the rains that we do have are going to be more intense, that may cause more flooding, for instance. And of course, that flooding has all sorts of effects on the environment. It causes erosion. It declines water quality. Of course, this has a huge impact on our infrastructure. It affects transportation, agriculture, you name it. And so really what this report was, a laundry list of the struggles that we've had. And, you know, we've just talked about Wisconsin, but, you know, the report also addresses the country as a whole. And they talk about the drought in the Southwest. They talk about the forest fires in, you know, Colorado and the central part of the country. The report also talks about rising sea levels, which some areas on the West and East Coast are experiencing as we speak. Now, it may not affect Wisconsin directly necessarily, but all of those things affect the certainly our nation's economy, and certainly globally affects the economy.
So any good news in this report? Because as I'm looking down the list of things, the bullet points you brought in here, I don't see a lot.
Well, I mean, scientists argue that there is certainly mitigation that can happen. Scientists would argue that we need to lower the level of the pollutants that are actually making climate change worse, that there needs to be a change in policy in order to make that happen. And, you know, a lot of this pollution is due in part to the burning of coal, oil, gas. You know, much of it comes from the production of energy. And what these scientists and certainly the Obama administration is pushing for are, you know, policies that will lessen the amount of these pollutants in the atmosphere, certainly in hopes of, if anything, slowing climate change.
All right. So that's a look at what happened in the next week or so. What stories are you going to be keeping an eye on?
Well, we'll be keeping a close eye on John Doe, too. What happens certainly in the courts, you know, when prosecutors, if prosecutors file their appeal of Judge Randa's ruling, that's certainly something we're going to keep a very close eye on. And of course, as we talked about earlier, we're in the midst of a governor's campaign. So you never know what's going to happen there.
But there's going to be plenty of it, I'll bet.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Noah.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Noah Ovshinsky is Wisconsin Public Radio's assistant news director, and he joins us every week at about this time to bring us up to date in what's making news here in Wisconsin.